What if your mother gets Alzheimer's, Wesley? And because she has Alzheimer's, you're not able to do as much writing as you used to do or as much traveling for public speaking as you used to do. Don't you think she should have a duty to die?
Wesley Smith, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
I went through that very thing. And hell no, is my answer. Hell no, my mother didn't have a duty to die. I had a duty to take care of her. That is a Christian duty, and it's also a human duty. And if we ever lose sight of that fact, the duty to die will be the least of our problems.
You can listen to Wesley Smith's presentation, Making the Case for the Hippocratic Oath, on a recording from the 2019 Making the Case Conference. For a year-end tax-deductible contribution of $300, we'll send it to you, along with a recording of 15 Advent and Christmas hymns. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Elsa, the past is not what it seems. You must find the truth. Go north, across the enchanted land, and into the unknown. But be careful. We have always feared Elsa's powers were too much for this world. Must hope. They are enough.
That's an excerpt from the movie Frozen 2. It follows as the sequel to the blockbuster Frozen. It is set in, well, kind of a real slash magical world. That line that we heard there in the trailer, the past is not what it seems, how accurate to the past, even to the legend that it's based upon, is Frozen and Frozen 2. We're going to be reviewing Frozen 2. Pastor Ted Geese joins us. He has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and he taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's start with Frozen 2. Why do you say that it's a movie like this is a reason why families need to start catechizing and teaching their children as soon as possible?
Well, I end off the review saying that, you know, if families don't teach their children, films like Frozen 2 will be happy to do it. So essentially, like, the world and movies like this will catechize your kids. They will teach your kids, you know, without you being there, basically. If you're not willing to step up to the plate when it comes to questions that might arise out of the film. And listen, this goes for Christians who would watch a film like this, like for Lutheran families that go to a film like this. But it would even go for, like, I don't know, like Hindu families or Muslim families, because what's presented in this film is going to probably be much different from what they as a family would believe. It certainly is different than what Christians would believe. And that's because the majority of this film, like, really, actually, this film in its entirety has its roots kind of in, its modern roots are in neo-paganism. And we can get into more of that as we talk about this film.
So, sequel to Frozen. Frozen, obviously, a huge hit. And a hit not only in terms of its box office, but in terms of the musical score. How does Frozen 2 stack up in terms of how big a hit the first one was?
Well, it doesn't have any big songs in it like you get in the first film. So that's where it's kind of lacking. It doesn't have a Let It Go in its repertoire. It's not going to have that kind of thing. There is kind of a lullaby that is reprised at a couple of different times throughout the course of the film. And that is probably one of the better ones. It's one about a river. And we can talk a bit about the nature of the song itself, but that's the one that probably is going to be the one that, you know, there's a couple songs in there, but they're already, like, for me, they're already kind of starting to fade.
How does it pick up where Frozen left off? Give us kind of a plot summary of number one leading into number two.
Well, number one, it really focused on these two sisters, so Elsa and her sister Anna. Elsa has some mysterious magical powers. She can control ice and snow and things like that, freeze things. And that becomes a bit of a problem because pretty much anything she touches will freeze. So she has to kind of conceal that. Through the course of the first film, she kind of gives up. She lets it go, that whole concealing it part, and then starts to embrace that. She also ends up becoming queen of this fictional Norwegian kingdom of Arendelle in the first film. And that's kind of, they go on a bit of an adventure when it comes to all of this, the magic end of it. And of course, the sister, Anna, played by, voiced by Kristen Bell, doesn't want to lose her sister. So it's really, it's a story about sisters. And this film kind of continues that story about sisters, but in a slightly different way, in that by this point, you know, Elsa is fairly entrenched as being the queen of Arendelle. But you get this kind of flashback at the beginning of Frozen 2 where bits and pieces of their own past start coming to the forefront. So they find out, you know, about this enchanted forest and how their father had been to this enchanted forest and that this is still an enchanted forest. And Elsa starts to hear kind of a voice calling her, a song, kind of just a sound of a voice calling her, and she wants to investigate. That kind of gets the ball rolling on the film.
The villain in the first one is not the villain in the second one. How does that work?
Yeah, the villain in the first one, he kind of gets his comeuppance along the way. He becomes an unnecessary character. He's essentially a guy who is kind of a prince from another country that was kind of interloping into the family, kind of plotting to maybe take over the whole place for himself. That was what you got in the first film. In the second one, you don't really know who the villain is at first because they kind of play those cards fairly close to their vest. So then the whole movie kind of starts being kind of more about a transformation, a couple different kinds of transformations that are going on in the film. In the end, it is revealed that their grandfather, who they hear about in this flashback as kids, he had been up to this northern kingdom, or not really even a kingdom, as much as a land filled with tribal people. So this is the indigenous people in Norway, and that he had been up there because they had built this dam on a river. And it turns out that, like, the way the story is told at the beginning is that there's the magic in the enchanted woods kind of like erupts and people die, everybody gets frozen up into it, and they're stuck up there. The people who got stuck up there are stuck up there in this enchanted forest. What gets revealed by the end of the film, spoilers for people, is that the grandfather of Elsa and Anna, he didn't build the dam just to help the people of Northumbria. He built it to control them. So he becomes an evil colonialist type of character, and it's his arrogance and prejudices that become the villainous thing that needs to be overcome by the end of the film.
You also say that the first film kind of at least gave a tip of the hat to some of both the mythic and the historical framework for the Frozen story, whereas the second one has pretty much sanitized most of that out of there.
This is where things get a little strange and complicated. Disney likes to take fairy tales and turn them into films, or to take stories that are in the popular zeitgeist or things that people know and bring them into films. So in the case of a movie like Pocahontas, they were bringing an actual historical character and bringing it into, you know, an animated feature. In this case, it's a Hans Christian Andersen little folktale that he wrote. It's an original one of his called The Snow Queen. And they kind of lifted some of the ideas out of that, made it into their own film for that first Frozen film. But they took out from there any Christian things out of that film, out of that story, rather, and didn't include it in their film. So that story, I went and looked at it. It includes like a Bible verse from Matthew 18:3. Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. It even has characters praying the Lord's Prayer when they're in a jam, and it has the effect of God helping them in their time of need. So that stuff was not included in the first Frozen film. And the director, writer-director team of Chris Buck and Jennifer Lee, who did the first film and now have done this one, they set their story in 19th century Norway. So like mid-1800s in Norway, the Sami people who are up there as the indigenous people are the ones that these Northundrian tribal people are based on for this second film. And also the character of Kristoff, who's the reindeer herdsman, he's one of these Sami indigenous persons from up there as well. So you had a little bit of that actual kind of historical stuff woven into it, and also into this film, of actual things that you would find in 1800s Norway. The trouble is that mid-19th century Norway was Lutheran. Like, they were all Lutherans there. And in fact, the Sami people at that point would have identified as Lutherans already for a couple hundred years from the time of the Reformation. And Roman Catholics had been going up there since the 13th century, bringing the Christian faith to the people there. So as all of these things always happen in history, sometimes it goes well, sometimes it's heavy-handed, sometimes it's very Christ-like and gentle, and other times it's very heavy-handed. So there's kind of a mixed history of the actual history of what happened. So all of this is, why would any of this be worth us talking about now? Well, Disney, like they did with Aladdin, when they went and had people from the Middle Eastern, South Asian community that they consulted with for that film, they again did that in this case. So they went to the Sami people and they consulted with their elders and got a picture of what pre-Christian Sami religious practices and beliefs would be like. So they've included that in this story. Now this is where it starts getting lopsided, because the Sami people that the Northundians are based on, if this is all things being equal and taking the actual history into account, they would share a Christian faith and they would be Lutherans. Like both the indigenous tribal people and the people of Arendelle would have that. And the likelihood of them having these pre-Christian neo-pagan, what we would say now is neo-pagan kind of style beliefs, or pagan beliefs, the odds are very slim that that would be the case by the mid-1800s. So it's kind of a misrepresentation of history. And listen, I get it. This is a movie about magic, and it's nonsense with a talking snowman. But they kind of open themselves up to some additional thought about this when they consult elders from the Sami people for how they're going to be represented in the films. Does that make some kind of sense?
Well, I mean, it just sounds like they have chosen an alternate history in which to set, an intentionally alternate history in which to set this fanciful tale.
A kind of revised history. So you hear about revisionist history, and that's kind of what you got here. And in the first film, when Elsa is having her coronation, there is a bishop there that would have been a Lutheran bishop who is presiding over the coronation. Well, by the end of this film, again, spoilers, Anna, the sister, is the one who becomes queen in place of Elsa. And in theory, she would have a coronation also. Now, if this happens off camera, who knows, but she doesn't have the bishop there. So in the spots where they could have, because she's also engaged to be married by the end of the film, and whether they are married or not by the end of it is a little bit vague, her and Kristoff. Either way, a marriage and a coronation are times where you would have the Lutheran bishop there for a queen or a princess who's becoming a queen. So they chose not to include that stuff. And that's why it starts to get a little more lopsided. That's important because the film itself has a theme of balance. And the idea is that these sisters become an embodiment of a balance between these two worlds of Northundria and Arendelle. But it is, like I said, kind of a lopsided balance.
Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. We're reviewing the movie Frozen 2. On the other side of the break, there's a transformation, not just a character transformation, but an actual transformation over the characters from human into A Fifth Element. We'll talk about it next.
And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see?
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll study John the Baptist's swan song, Jesus and the Samaritan Woman, the true worship of God, the Samaritans believe in Jesus, and Jesus heals the official son. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, as we continue our walk through St. John's Gospel on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org, thewordendures.org.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you concerned that nativity scenes aren't being displayed in public places? Why not display one at your church or your home? The Outdoor Nativity Store produces durable, affordable, and American-made outdoor nativities for Christians around the world. To view a variety of nativity sets, visit outdoornativitystore.com. These nativities will hold up under the harshest weather conditions, snow, ice, and wind. The Outdoor Nativity Store, outdoornativitystore.com.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support, through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small-town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM or give us a call at our office. We're here to help.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, November the 26th, we're reviewing the movie Frozen 2. Pastor Ted Geese is our guest. Ordinarily, Ted, we talk about a story arc for characters. There's a transformation of their personality in some way, but there's actually a transformation of one of the characters here in Frozen 2 from human being into what, a fifth element?
Yeah, so this is where, again, some of these ideas of magic and pagan kind of ideas are really up front and center in the film. Essentially, what you have is animism, shamanism, polytheism, all kind of happening within the Northumbrian indigenous people within the storyline. And the character of Elsa, it's, by again, spoilers, by the end of the film, it's revealed that her mother, so Anna and Elsa's mother, was from those tribal people. So the indigenous people, she was from them, and that this magical ability that Elsa has actually was kind of passed down in that way from generation to generation. She hears this call up into the north. She heeds the call. They go into the enchanted forest together. And in the course of the film, she goes through something like the technical term for it would be apotheosis. She goes kind of through a deification where she is the fifth element. So fire, water, earth, and you know, air or whatever, all of these things, there's like this fifth element that kind of binds it all together, or, you know, is at the heart and center of all of it. She is that. She becomes the protector of the woods. She takes on this kind of shamanistic role by the end of it. You know, she controls the spirit of water in the form of a horse and can turn it into ice when she wants it to run on the earth, or she can ride it on the water. She kind of like turns into this thing that she wasn't before. And there's even a moment where she freezes completely up. Her sister kind of helps her out of that. And then afterwards, she is different. And she has transitioned from one thing, transformed into another. And to the point where she knows she can only go back to visit Arendelle. She can't live there anymore. Her place is in the north, away from her previous life. So this is the way, the direction that this story goes for the character of Elsa.
Does the, I think the enchantment for a lot of little girls who watched Frozen was the fact that she eventually becomes a queen. Kind of difficult for little girls to aspire to become a fifth element of nature.
Yeah, a demigod of some sort. That's a little different, but you know, like girls like horses. Like lots of little girls like horses. And by the end of the movie, she has this really cool horse. So, I mean, there's, on the one hand, these are movies made for little kids, right? So you have that. But at the same time, they are movies made by adults, which means that adults get to make the decisions about what go into the films. And then on top of that, there are just adults that enjoy going to see these movies. I mean, it's not one of my first choices, but, you know, and I did watch the first one a couple years after it actually came out because it kept coming up and coming up. So I finally watched it. So, you know, this is not the first choice of a movie I'd want to watch, but it made the most money this last weekend, and it's going to go on to make piles of money. It's also going to be in high rotation in all sorts of households for families around North America and around the world.
I've read several critiques that have said it's really preachy when it comes to girl power, or to put it in adult terms, feminist themes.
It is, sure. That's, you know, the idea that women don't need the things that traditionally women might need. That's the case in this movie. I mean, from the vantage point of a Lutheran pastor, that is lower on the list of things about this film that are more problematic. I see like some of the religious things that are going on in this film to be more worthy of thinking about off the top. I mean, you eventually might want to get around to some of that stuff, but I think that it's not, if you're going to pick something, that's not the biggest thing. And I know that coming into this film, some people were wondering about, because there was a big push within the LGBTQ community to make Elsa into a gay character of some kind, a lesbian or something like that. They don't really go that direction. This is not the way this goes. Like, I've seen some people who have commentated on it and said that there are hints and nods and things in there, and there may be. But all of those things seem to be kind of not on the forefront of what's going on in this particular film. Not in the same kind of way that maybe some of the very clear religious implications, you know, as far as that goes. And again, like a lot of people are going to watch this movie and that these things might not be the first thing they think of, but they're going to be there the 8, 9, 10, 12, 40 times that the kids watch it. It's going to be there the whole entire time.
In terms of its spectacle, its animation, how does it come across?
Oh, it's really well rendered. It's very beautiful. It's it's a lot better than the original one. But of course, you know, a lot of water has gone under the bridge now. Like 2013 is like an eon ago compared to 2019 when it comes to these computer animated films. You know, it's in the ballpark with not quite maybe as beautifully rendered as Toy Story 4, but it's right up there. It has some really kind of beautiful imagery in it. It's really well made. In fact, one of the animators is from Humboldt, Saskatchewan, just up the road from us here in Regina, Saskatchewan. So I guess he's a what do they call that? A telecommuter or whatever. He commutes in via his home office kind of a thing. Yeah, I mean, it's a really well made movie. That's for sure.
Ted, there's an irony here that I'm sure has not been lost on you, that Disney's kind of the ultimate white imperial superpower when it comes to media. I mean, it's enormous. It's global. And it strikes me that in writing this kind of revisionist history, albeit in a children's animated film like Frozen, it is imposing its idea of what should have happened in Norway among the indigenous people back on those indigenous people.
It is kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? I think that, like, they are doing consultation with these people groups, and that's commendable. The question is just how well are they doing it? And then the other question is, do they realize that they're doing it? Like, do they see that they've waltzed right into this thing? Are they knowingly doing it, or are they doing it through ignorance? This is a question that kind of comes to my mind as I'm watching it, because really, like, the neo-pagan movement comes out of white Western European academic and popular culture kind of movements of the 19th century. It draws upon Romanticism. It does have some roots back into humanism. But, you know, like, these are people usually who have a grudge against the church, against monarchies and states and things like that. So then they come up with stuff like, they cook up things like neo-druids, right? Like the new kind of druids, or Wicca by, like, Gerald Massey. He's the guy who came up with, he was connected to the druids. He's connected to this Wicca movement. So from these same circles, and perhaps really well-meaningly, they end up encouraging Aboriginal, Indigenous people to set aside what they previously believed as Christians in a lot of cases, and go back to things from before that period, or to kind of reignite whatever was left being passed down. And a lot of that is because of their own personal colonial guilt. And this kind of metastasizes and goes into all of the universities, into the university systems around the world, and becomes something that probably anthropologists and psychologists and people like that don't even realize that they're doing, maybe necessarily. But the question is, how do you honor your past? Like, if you're an Indigenous person, how do you honor your past? Do you honor them only up to a certain point? And then when your ancestors start to believe in Christ and become Christians, those ones, you can't honor those ones? Like, how does it work? And I think that this is a question that Indigenous people who watch this film might want to ask. And it should maybe be a question that all people, like, should be asking as they watch things like this. Does Disney know what they're doing, or don't they? And especially when you take, like, a character like a grandfather and you turn him into the villain, and you imply that, of course, the grandfather is prejudiced and doesn't know what's going on, and he's out of touch. Are they subtly or not so subtly trying to convince or imply to young kids that they shouldn't trust their own grandparents? Disney kind of wanders into these things, and I don't know if they knowingly do it or you know, ignorantly do it at times, but they do have a big reach and a big influence, and I think that would be worth thinking about, and families should really take the time to talk about this with their kids afterwards.
You have watched a lot of Disney films. If you were to kind of summarize it for someone, what do you think they're up to? What is their message to our children that they keep repeating it again and again and again in these animated features?
How do you put this? So on the one hand, you could say that maybe they, more often than not, it seems to be, there is a little bit of a don't trust adults vibe going on, which is kind of weird. It does show up over and over and over again. We don't probably have time to talk about the dozens of times that kind of thing shows up. But that's there. Plus, you know, they have, like, all of the moralisms and things that they just kind of, like, roll through history picking up whatever's popular at the time, because they're a company trying to make money. So on the one hand, yes, they want to be quote-unquote on the right side of history, but the other side of it too, they want to try to figure out how to do that and make money. So I think they are interested in what's popular in the moment, and they don't want to look like they're being insensitive. So when it's pointed out that they're being insensitive, like was the case with Frozen, the first Frozen movie, then they want to make up for that. So sometimes that's good, but how do the outcomes come? Like, what comes out of it? That's, I think, the question that people want to just continue to think about. Even though it's a kid's movie, even though it's about magic, even though it's goofy and not really based in anything historical, still, it's worth thinking about.
Pastor Ted Geese taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity and the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. You can read his review of Frozen 2 at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. In about a half hour, you can hear part two of our conversation with Pastor Geese. We'll get a review of the movie A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is called Praise and Honor, Hymn-Inspired Devotions. It goes through the stanzas of 14 well-loved hymns and has a devotional thought for each one of them. It's a good devotional resource for, say, the season of Advent that is about to begin. Find out more about Praise and Honor at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. In hour two of Issues Etc., Bill McKeever joins us to talk about a Salt Lake Tribune story about the history of polygamy in Mormonism. Is it making a comeback? We'll find out after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.